From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. It was historic and maybe a little awkward. Yesterday, President-elect Barack Obama and his family met with President George Bush for a tour of the White House. It's not just the tenants of the White House that are changing. Senator Obama and his team are proposing some big changes in government, too. For more on the transition to the White House, we have NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Farai.
So, Senator Obama hasn't been particularly supportive of President Bush's administration. He's referred to 8 failed years of policy when he was on the campaign trail. But now he said it's time to put politics aside. And given what's been going on in the tensions between these two men and their philosophies, what kind of transition can we expect?
I think we're going to see a relatively orderly transition. This is something we've come to be spoiled about in the United States because compared to most countries in the world, our system almost celebrates the transfer of power as a kind of happy ritual in which we are glad that we don't have any more contentious back and forth and tests of power and strength to get there. On the other hand, we have seen in, for example, the year 2000, that it can take a little longer than the system is set up to normally expect. And under circumstances such as those 8 years ago, of course, it took 5 weeks to determine the winner of the presidential election, then it can be strained and truly difficult, particularly when you have a change of power between the two parties. But I think given the economic situation the country's in right now, the financial meltdown, also the two wars that are continuing, the rather large number of people, 6 figures, who are in combat around the world for the United States, in times such as these, the transition really needs to be as cordial and as respectful and as orderly as possible.
What about rollbacks of policies? Because there are a lot of different policy approaches, everything from big ones like the Guantanamo prison camps in Cuba to smaller ones that Senator Obama disagrees with. What do you think he's going to focus on changing, say, within the first 100 days of his term?
The first thing he'll need to do is to look down a list, which is being prepared even now, of executive orders that have changed federal policy over the last 8 years. These are things the president can do on his own, things the president can do without asking Congress for anything, for authority, for money, for confirmation of an appointment. So when the president can simply say, the federal government will now do X or Y or Z, or the opposite of what it had been doing, wherever that's possible, that's the first place where a president can have some impact. And it's also sometimes the last place a president can have some impact. In the final weeks of this presidency, we expect George W. Bush to try to issue a lot of executive orders to set certain policies in place, and those will probably be among the first ones that Barack Obama tries to reverse starting January 21st, the day after he takes the oath of office.
Give me an example of something that might fall under that category.
One of the big ones is the treatment of federal research dollars that go for supporting research to attack certain diseases. Those dollars have been prohibited up to now by the Bush administration from going to any research that's based on stem cells taken from human embryos. If human embryos were involved, the Bush administration did not want that research to go forward because it destroyed those human embryos, which potentially, although most of them were on their way to being destroyed as medical waste, potentially those could develop into human beings. So the Bush administration took the view that that was a kind of sacrifice of life, and therefore they didn't want to fund with federal money any such research. Some of it went forward, of course, with private money. And the Bush administration was more than willing to fund stem cell research as long as the stem cells came from some other source other than human embryos. That is a controversial position because, of course, it greatly restricts the amount of research that can go on in an area that many scientists regard as highly promising to cure many different diseases. And so we expect, given his position in the Senate and what he has said in his campaign, that'll be one of the first policies Barack Obama reverses.
All right. What about veterans' health care? It is Veterans Day. There was a Dole Shalala Commission in the last outgoing administration, that tried to take a look at the needs of veterans and health care. Do you think that Senator Obama is going to make that a priority?
Yes, I do. Surprisingly, this was not an area in which the Bush administration, with all of its emphasis on the military, really covered itself in glory. They left themselves very vulnerable on this, both the Walter Reed Hospital and a number of other ways. This is something where the Obama administration can immediately endear itself to the veterans community.
All right, Ron, great to talk to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Farai.
That was Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor, and he spoke to us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. Millions of people have their own personal laundry list of what they want from an Obama administration. So what big issues, if any, do Black Americans share as top priorities? And how will the incoming administration deal with them? Joining us now, we've got Clarence Page, a columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Hi, Clarence.
Hi, Farai. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. So we're going to dig into these issues deeper, but this is really just a quick tour. Healthcare. The two nominees battled over this issue. Senator Obama focused on expanding access to health care and a plan that could have cost up to $65 billion by some estimates. Do you think, A, this is a priority that a lot of members of the African-American community want to see dealt with? And B, is there any money to deal with it, or will there be any money to deal with it?
Well, the answer to A is yes, because African-Americans disproportionately are in greater need of health care. We currently have health coverage, of course, government health coverage for seniors, and for the indigent, those below the poverty line. But the working poor and middle-class folks often get caught in the crunch, especially now in these economically troubled times, issues like portability, being able to take it from one job to another, or having care when you lose your job. Those are very important and were a very high priority in the campaign. Barack Obama's campaign was launched on the anti-war issue, but health care soon took center stage, which gets us to question B: can we afford it? And the short answer is no. Right now, in the short term, the government is deeply into debt with the bailout package, current bailout package, and possibly more bailout actions pending. The economy may get worse before it gets better. So Barack Obama has to make some decisions here as to how to deal with this very important issue for him. Will he try early on to take measures that will put us on the path to a full-out debate on this issue, or will he hold off for a while and tackle the other bigger economic issues first?
One of the things that came up is the idea that you could pay for things like this health care plan by rolling back the Bush administration's tax cuts for people who earned a quarter of $1 million or more. Is there the political power, I guess, within Senator Obama and within the Democratic-led legislative branch to really roll back those tax cuts?
It looks like there is. Obama seems to have a mandate for that, since that issue also took center stage in the debate. And the Bush tax cuts have long been a thorn in the sides of the Democrats and of our nation's fiscal health, for that matter. You remember John McCain opposed the Bush tax cuts initially and only began to support them as he got closer to running for president. And because they do appeal to conservatives, to Republicans in general, except for the fiscal conservatives who are much more concerned about balancing the budget. So I think he's got the mandate to do that. And like any other budgetary decision now, it's a question of will rolling back those tax cuts, and actually all mainly what he would do would be to resume the cuts. In other words, the Bush tax cuts expire in 2010, and he could just essentially let them expire as far as those who are above $250,000 a year income. That's far enough down the road that it makes it even more politically easy to take the steps now.
All right. Let's turn to education. Senator Obama has said he wants to reform No Child Left Behind, and that's the education law that President Bush enacted in 2002.
Right.
And the Obama campaign literature said that reform, quote, starts by funding the law. What does that mean?
That means they want to have it both ways. I think, well, what President-elect Obama has been speaking to here is the unpopularity of No Child Left Behind with a lot of people, teachers' unions, with a lot of ordinary citizens who think it imposes too much at the federal level on the states. However, there's a popular aspect of No Child Left Behind in that it calls for accountability by the schools. In fact, District of Columbia School Superintendent Michelle Rhee, who played a role, unintended, in the third presidential debate when the issue of education vouchers and all came up, she has said that she, even though she supports Obama, she's frightened, she said, of his statements about No Child Left Behind because she appreciates the accountability aspects of that law. So I think we're going to see a bit more debate about No Child Left Behind before it's just done away with completely. And also, who will be the new Secretary of Education? There's been rumors that Colin Powell might take the job. Those might just be rumors, but somebody like him would certainly favor accountability. And Barack Obama has also spoken out for accountability in the past.
All right. One last question, and it's going to have to be quick.
Okay.
Yesterday, Keith Reed, who's one of our regular economics contributors, said that there could be a new deal, meaning the government will create jobs directly. Do you think that's possible?
You know, I tend to, well, it's certainly popular with Democrats, the idea of public works. And it's already worked in Chicago, Obama's adopted hometown. Mayor Daley's gotten a long way with that. But I suspect he may be more of a new frontier kind of president, at least initially. And that's the John F. Kennedy model, where he raised the morale of the country and rallied people together for joint action to tackle common problems instead of coming out with public works programs.
All right. Clarence, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Clarence Page, columnist for the Chicago Tribune. And just ahead, they rocked and wrapped the vote. So what can young Americans expect in return? We'll talk to performers and organizers about the future of youth politics. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. All of this happened because of you. That line comes from an email message that Senator Barack Obama sent to supporters a week ago, just before he took the stage as president-elect in Chicago's Grant Park. And he owes a lot to young voters. We're going to talk about the youth vote with Valisha Butterfield. She's executive director of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, an advocacy group founded by music producer Russell Simmons. And we've also got Bakari Kitwana, author of the book The Hip Hop Generation and founder and CEO of Rap Sessions. Rap Sessions put together a series of town hall meetings this year on issues facing the hip-hop generation. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. So, Valisha, let me start with you. We've had on Russell Simmons several times to talk about what he does, and yet there are so many questions about what exactly it is like to try to get young people to vote who don't want to vote, because I think that's something that comes up a lot in, you know, in various communities, that people have all sorts of reasons that they think that voting doesn't matter. Give me an example, if you had a chance to talk to someone who really believed that voting didn't matter, and what you said to that person.
As we've traveled the country over the last 8 years, we've talk to people directly, face-to-face, young adults between 18 to 29 years old. And what we found is that there's a resounding thought and belief that politicians in Washington, D.C. do not care about the youth vote and what matters to young people. And, you know, rather they play politics and are controlled by Washington, D.C. So I think young adults really felt like their voice didn't matter and their vote didn't count. And therefore, the apathy was there and they just didn't turn out.
So what did you do to try to turn folks around? Because the youth vote did work. There was a strong youth turnout this time around.
Absolutely. We found that it was a matter of translation, how the message and how the important points were translated to the young adults. So rather than hearing it from someone like, you know, a Washington politician or you or I, instead we leveraged and utilized our relationships with hip hop artists, those who young adults looked up to, respected and followed, to translate that message for us and be the messenger of what the real issues were in the election, civic engagement, why it's important to register to vote, but most importantly, go out to the polls. And it really worked. It connected with the young people. But I think in this election, we found more than ever that the issues really mattered and young adults resonated with those issues. So that combined with the celebrity aspect for us really helped young adults get excited, but most importantly, helped us sustain that momentum all the way until November the 4th.
Bakari, you went from someone who wrote a book about the hip hop generation and helped define it to someone who's really done a lot of studies about this group of people. And you actually talk about how it's there are different subsegments. So before I get to the subsegments, overall, how do you think the hip hop generation did this time around at the polls?
I think the hip hop generation has continued to increase their participation. And it was up in 2004 from 2000, up in 2006, and again in 2008. So I think we've seen a steady increase. I think a lot of the catalyst for that has been hip-hop amongst young people, just making voting and politics more fashionable. I think we saw the Will.i.am video this year. The 2004 video that Eminem did, Mosh, I think was even more political and had as significant an impact. It just was not seen as widely felt in the mainstream culture.
Well, that video, I remember the video Mosh that Eminem did, but it came out so late in the campaign. And
right.
I think that one thing that was markedly different was that when you saw the kind of intersection of pop culture and politics, it was infused and suffused throughout the entire campaign. But do you think overall that it really does make a difference? Both of you have analyzed or dealt directly with the issue of celebrity. Do you think it really does make a difference to people, say, between 18 and 29, to know that celebrities support their political participation?
I think that it makes a difference in terms of, I think that hip-hop artists, most certainly, I think, have a way of making things seem cool or fashionable. I think that's a catalyst. I don't know to what extent we could contribute the turnout in this election to hip hop alone, because I think that Barack is such a Barack Obama, Senator Obama, now President-elect Obama, is such a figure that motivates and inspires, that we saw just a huge turnout across the board. So I think there are women groups that want to take credit for this election. There are hip-hop groups that want to take credit and others. But I think that just the candidacy and the way the issues were framed had a lot to do with it also.
Felicia, what do you think?
Absolutely. If we just look at the facts for a moment, over 22 million young Americans, as you said, between 18 and 29 years old, voted in this election. And it was the second highest youth voter turnout that we've seen in American history. So we can't give hip hop or celebrities all of the credit. You know, although we've seen an increase over the years in each election cycle in youth participation, and that has had a lot to do with celebrities and their involvement, this year and last week was really historical for all of us, and you can't point the finger, as he just said, to one group or one segment. It has really been a collective effort, and the message, I mean, you know, Senator or President-elect Obama received youth vote 2-1 over McCain in this election. So I think his message really stuck and resonated, and young people felt connected to it. So the celebrities helped, no doubt. But, you know, we had the Vote or Die campaigns. We had the Hip Hop Summit in 2004. But in this election cycle, we just broke through all expectations. And it had a lot to do with the overall just expectations of this country and the need and desire for young people to really seek change.
All right. I want to bring someone else in the conversation. We've got Derek Ashong. He is a musician, does not belong to any political party, and he spent more than a year trying to convince voters to support Barack Obama. First, he used music. Then he got caught on tape or was participating on tape having a heated conversation with a reporter about health care. We have a little bit of that conversation. Take a listen.
It hasn't been the political will. That's been the big problem.
Is it the political or the economic will?
It's a combination of both, but I think if you've got the political will, you have people who are courageous enough to take a stance. And that's one of the things I like about Senator Obama. I think that he's courageous enough to try new things. Mm-hmm. And it's not to take something away from the other candidates, but I feel like you're having the same old stuff, try it again, and it's not working. We need something different.
All right, Derek, so you got so far over a million hits on YouTube for sort of laying out your policy analysis. So, that's a great accomplishment in and of itself. But what kind of responses did you get from people, particularly younger voters or potential voters, when they were responding to what you said?
I had a really positive response, actually. One of the biggest things I kept hearing was kind of almost like a thank you, because at the time there was all of this discourse around the idea that Senator Obama was a rock star politician, all style, no substance. And people were implying that young voters were drawn to the mystique around him as opposed to his actual policies. And this kind of worked towards dispelling that myth that a new generation of voters didn't know what's going on. I think the other thing that was really cool for me to hear back from people is that they felt that they understood the issue, in that case, healthcare, better after watching the clip. So all in all, I feel like it was a positive moment as far as my support of the candidate and as far as like just representing a different analysis of the role of youth and the understanding of youth about what is going on in the campaign.
I just want to reintroduce a couple of the other people we have in the conversation. We've also got Valisha Butterfield, Executive Director of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, and we have Bakari Kitwana, author of The Hip Hop Generation, founder of Rap Sessions. When you think about, from your perspective, Derek, you are someone who does use your music to really talk about social issues as well as being able to talk about them yourself. What do you think as a performer is the value of using music and other forms of art to really address political issues?
I think that's a great question. Bob Marley had a quote that I always love to harken back to, and that is, one good thing about music, when it hits, you feel no pain. And I've always felt that one of the problems we've had historically in this country, or at least in the last, 20 years or so, is that there isn't a lot of dialogue between people on the red state, blue state side of the divide, right? So sometimes people will act like other Americans are virtually aliens. And the funny thing about music is we can rock a party in Manhattan and then the next week be playing in Wyoming. And people are equally receptive because they're not assuming that I'm coming here to plug a candidate or a particular issue, but that I'm sharing something that is creative and that they can buy into. Now, once these people get a chance to commune with you and see what you're all about and see what you're singing about, they're going to be much more open to a dialogue about just about anything than if I came there with an Obama sticker on my shirt, which is not to say that we don't need people on the ground working for the campaigns, but it is to say that I think that artists need to move beyond paying almost lip service to supporting candidates and actually start creating music that reflects the best of what we want to see in society as opposed to simply what we think will sell.
Valisha, we've had all sorts of different artists on this show. David Banner came on and talked to us about politics and straight ahead politics, hip hop politics, and all that. But there's been a lot of critique that hip hop has drifted away from being a form of relevant social critique and dialogue. How do you address what hip hop can be or should be as you do the work that you do? And do the people who work with you as artists who go out on the road or come to your events to speak, do they have to be people who show an appreciation for political lyrics as well as political action?
What we found is that the artists that we work with, and we have a vast network of not only hip-hop artists, but professional athletes and actors and actresses and across the board. And what we found is that their art form oftentimes reflects the harsh realities that people deal with and face every single day in their communities throughout the nation. So we never want to censor an artist that we work with, and we try not to be discriminatory in who we allow to participate on our panels and to get young people encouraged to vote, as long as the message is something that is positive or at least honest and a true depiction of what we feel does exist in society. But we do always encourage the artists that we work with to take back responsibility, seek a higher message, and hopefully put out a more relevant message that young people can connect with, but also aspire to be better. So we never want to just wallow in self-pity or whatever the situation or economic circumstances are, but we do encourage and challenge not only the artists but the constituents that we have to aspire to be better, and we believe that they're headed in that direction, and this was evidenced last week.
Bakari, let me turn back to you. You are someone, again, who's been tracking the hip-hop generation. You also see there being some sub-segments within the hip-hop generation. Tell me a little bit about what you see in terms of demographics.
Right. I start to talk about this in some detail in my book, Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop, and that is there are two generations born after the Civil Rights Movement. There's the hip-hop generation, people born between 1965 and 1984, and then there's a younger generation, many of whom are between the ages of 18 and 24 right now. And so you have these two generations, and I think that when we talk about electoral politics and we talk about voting, a lot of times we just talk about young people in general, and we're not making distinctions. I think that we're starting to see some subtle shifts between the views of these two generations, and I think the 18 to 24 and a little bit older set, they are a little bit more politically savvy than members of the hip-hop generation. And in our survey that we did, Understanding the Hip-Hop Voting Block, which came out a week before the election, we found that 18 to 24-year-olds were 90% more likely to say race didn't matter in their choice for president, whereas you got into the 25 to 34-year-old set, the number dropped to 81. And so you're starting to see some subtle differences between these two age groups in terms of the issues that matter to them, in terms of who they wanted to see in the White House and what they want to see the president focus on after the inauguration.
Derek, when you think about you've been very successful using some unconventional means like the YouTube success to really reach out to people. But now there's the whole question of how do you hold politicians accountable for being available to members of younger generations? Do you have any thoughts? Because it sounds like you're essentially a political independent who felt passionately about Senator Obama's candidacy. Do you have any ideas about how you can hold this man who was just elected to the White House accountable?
Absolutely. I think that there are a couple of things. One is his constituents, the kind of grassroots base that the Obama campaign built, is something that really hasn't been seen in American politics prior to this time. And I think that that same network that was so effective in raising money and getting the word out and actually knocking on doors and making phone calls can be used to lobby on critical issues that the campaign wants to get done, particularly lobbying Congress to make sure that the White House and Congress are hopefully in accord on some key issues. At the same time, I think that we've got this massive opportunity right now with so many young people excited and thinking about the political arena and wondering what their next step could be to actually do something to solve potentially or at least help address two problems within the country, namely this sort of quote-unquote red state, blue state divide, and also some of the issues in our lagging educational system. And I think we really should take these young people and set up an internal Peace Corps where we can say to a college student, look, you can go and spend a semester, quote-unquote, abroad, but if you're going to school in Massachusetts, we're going to send you to spend a semester in Birmingham. If you're from Atlanta, we're going to send you to spend a semester in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And you will have the opportunity to actually work with kids in that community as an after-school teacher, as a teacher's assistant, working on special programs. It gives these students, the college students, the opportunity to see how people live in other parts of this country, because as I've traveled around, I've noticed that kids we talk to in Minnesota, many of them have never been to Brooklyn. They have no idea what life is really like on the East Coast and vice versa. And if you were to do that, not only do you help to bridge that divide, but you now start providing some resources to support our educational system as well.
All right. Well, we're going to have to end it here, but I think we're going to have all of you guys back on again soon. Thank you.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you.
We were speaking to Valisha Butterfield, Executive Director of the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, Bakari Kitwana, Founder and CEO of Rap Sessions. He joined us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. And also speaking to Derek Ashong, political activist and member of the band Soul Fresh. And He also has a song called From the Soul, which we're going to listen to in a second. He and Valisha joined us from our studios in New York.
Hey, y'all. Right from the soul, I say, light off the mic like it's judgment day. Yeah, oh, you shine like a solar flame. Burn out them eyes till I see you sing away, oh, and live it like you love it, yeah. For we who believe, no God died this way.
I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. It's one thing to celebrate the election of Barack Obama, as many Africans did. It's another to see how he lives up to those continental expectations. Samuel Dogmo is the founder of African Immigrants Movement for Barack Obama. He's also the director of biomedical informatics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine. We've also got with us Roxanne Lawson, who's here for this week's Africa Update, as well as this conversation. And she's director of Africa Policy for Trans Africa Forum. How you guys doing?
Well, thank you.
Pretty good. Thank you, Farai.
So, Samuel, we met at the Democratic National Convention, and you were there with so much enthusiasm. You've been working, or you worked, to rally African immigrants to get Senator Obama elected. So now that he has been, A, is your group still around and still active? And B, what do you want to see from him as a president?
Thank you, Feraya. This is another opportunity given to me to express my perspective regarding Senator Obama. As you remember, when I was in Denver, I told you that, you know, I had a feeling that he will win. And I'm very happy, you know, just like any Africans all around the world. We created that African immigrant movement to support Barack, to make sure that he becomes the next president of America. But having him president, it's not, you know, our definitive goal. We actually have to make sure that all the agenda that he had in mind, when he means, you know, we need to change, we have to make sure that that change actually going to be implemented. So the movement, it's not dead. We haven't stopped it. We continuing working, and we hope that we're going to help Senator Obama implement his agenda of hope.
What's the number one thing you would like to see him do regarding African issues?
That's a very good question, because we have so many issues, but I believe that the top priority for him, and we hope that he will do that, is actually to put enough pressure on African dictators to, you know, to make sure that they can improve the quality of life of people over there, that they could improve the human rights record over there, and also, you know, push them to adopt good governance.
Well, Roxanne, you know, when you think about how many different states there are on the continent of Africa, with all sorts of different priorities and all sorts of previous relationships to the U.S., is it possible to make any generalizations about what you think an African agenda might be, looking at the United States and the incoming president? Or is there too much political diversity?
Well, of course, there's extreme political diversity, but I think that both through government forces, through the African Union, and through civil society, they've been actually kind of unanimous about a couple of things. The need for international debt cancellation to be honored without harsh conditions, the need for fair trade for the continent of Africa that goes beyond oil, gas, and mining, the need for real human security issues to be addressed, and so for the U.S. and the U.S. administration to actually support true development on the continent and not just development of certain sectors that help the U.S. And U.S. businesses. I think that across the board we hear that. I think as well, African leaders are pretty unified in kind of the addressing of the conflicts that are going on the continent, what's going on in the DRC, in the Horn of Africa, a change in the U.S. foreign policy toward the Horn of Africa, as well as what's going on in Southern Africa, in Zimbabwe, and in Sudan. I think that there is some kind of uniformity around what they want from the next U.S. president.
Samuel, what do you think the role is going to be for African immigrants in the U.S. in terms of having a dialogue with the White House?
That's a good question. We hope that we will be basically the in-between between Africa in the continent and Barack Obama in the White House, that we will be able to talk to him, we will be able to convey to him the needs of Africa, and also going back to Africa, that we will be able to, you know, to lower the expectations, because, you know, coming back to that expectations issue, we have to make sure that all those expectations are realistic, because, you know, people are very happy, you know, high hopes. But we believe that we can play that role by explaining to them that the change that President Obama is talking about won't happen overnight.
Well, Samuel, I'm actually going to thank you for your time. Roxanne, stay with us. But Samuel, great to talk to you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Feraya. Anytime.
We were talking to Samuel Dongmo of African Immigrants Movement for Barack Obama. He's also with the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and in his spare time, he performs Afrobeat music as the artist Dr. Musica. Roxanne, let's shift gears now. I mean, we have had an opportunity to really talk about African immigrants and some of the political issues about Africa vis-a-vis this new incoming administration, but there are a lot of issues that are ongoing, the kinds of things that we talk about each week. And right now there is fighting in the Congo. Can you give us a little update on that?
I certainly can. The situation in the Congo, which is actually something that has been going on literally for the last on and off 14 years, that we thought there was some cessation of violence in 2006 with the UN peacekeeping forces, MONUC, being there and actually the Congolese people rallying together to have a free and fair election, or at least to try to have a free and fair election. But now it seems that despite the January conference, the Goma conference that happened between the Congolese government and the 22 armed groups, rebel groups with different political interests in the country, despite that coming together and the agreements that were made there, that the peace that's in the Congo, that fragile peace, has been broken. Last month, at the end of last month, one of the political parties in the Congo, political parties and slash military forces, the CNDP, which is led by a gentleman named Nkunda, began to basically have open warfare in the Congo, fighting with Congolese troops and displacing mass numbers of Congolese people. In that time, in the last couple of weeks, UN and international aid workers have been unable to do their jobs. 100,000 people have been displaced, adding to the numbers of already of about 100,000 people that were already displaced with the ongoing conflict. And the situation in the Congo is dire.
What role has the U.S. played in trying to deal with the humanitarian issues in the Congo? And what role do you see ahead, you know, in the waning period of time that we have with the Bush administration? And then, of course, this is somewhat speculative with an Obama administration.
Well, the U.S. has actually not played a very active, out front political role. They've ceded their kind of power to the European Union, and mostly we've been involved through our international business interests in the Congo. We have been a strong ally to Rwanda, and Rwanda, some people believe, is fueling the ongoing conflict that's happening in the Congo by backing Kunda, who they backed since the very beginning when he joined with other forces to put Mobutu out of power. And so the U.S. has actually been a fair weather friend to the Congolese people. What we hope going forward is that the U.S. will redouble its efforts in support of MONUC, which is severely underfunded and under-resourced, that there'll be more international troops that are there, and not just European troops or troops from the United States, but troops from all over the world who are French-speaking, who can work with the Congolese people to help restore peace. We also hope that the U.S. will actually change its investment packages toward the Congo. Right now, we've been mostly focusing our work in parts of the Congo that are fairly stable, in West Congo and Southern Congo, and not in the Eastern Congo, where most of the violence is happening. And that has helped to spur some development, but also has not actually dealt with the big problems in the Congo, which are problems that could easily spill out of the region of Eastern Congo to the rest of Congo and throughout the rest of Southern and Central Africa, to be fair.
I want to actually go to something cultural. We want to talk about someone that I know that you feel and many people feel has had a huge impact on international politics and culture. And we're talking about the South African singer Miriam Makeba, who died on Monday in Italy. She has been mourned by people across the continent and the world. fans called her Mama Africa. The apartheid government banned her albums and exiled her. Black Panther Stokely Carmichael chose her as his wife. We're talking about Miriam Makeba, a woman whose influence went far beyond the world of music. Makeba collapsed on stage in Italy on Sunday while singing her biggest hit. She was 76 years old. News & Notes producer Roy Hurst had the chance to speak with her in 2004.
I am not a politician, but I am a South African who feels and who knows where I come from and what we are going through. And I said, I don't sing politics, I merely sing the truth. And that's where Miriam Makeba became Miriam Makeba.
Yesterday we spoke with Harry Belafonte about Makeba's life and influence. He first met her in London in 1958, when she was already living in exile. Together they won a Grammy for Best Folk Recording in 1966. I asked Mr. Belafonte how he helped her gain entry to the U.S. and launch her international career.
I suggested to her that there might be some things that I could offer and some platforms I could extend to her that might help her develop a base in America and in Europe. And she accepted that offer. And for the next 7 years, we worked together almost, with great consistency. The first 3 years, she worked on my platform, in my concerts. And we went in several places around the world together. And we both had a chance to make history. The very first night she walked out on stage with me, at the end of the night, she just stood in the wings and wept. Because she had never quite experienced audiences the way in which she experienced the one that we sang together on. All the audiences thereafter were fairly young because it was a tour of the universities of America that I was doing at the time. And they just delighted in hearing her and the click song and singing in African tongues and the rhythms. The young people just absolutely delighted in it.
We were just hearing from musician and activist Harry Belafonte talking about the passing of South Africa's Miriam Makeba, Mama Africa. And we're talking as well to Roxanne Lawson, again, Trans Africa Forum's Director of Africa Policy. It's one of those things where, in certain ways, the conversation we've had today on the show has closed a loop, because we were just talking about the influence of music on political participation among the hip-hop generation. And this is a very different situation, but also a woman who used her music in order to shape politics. What kind of risks do you think that she took in order to be the woman that she was, and to say the kind of things she said throughout her life?
I imagine they must have been insurmountable to spend 31 years in exile just for wanting to practice your art, your music, to want to be yourself. As she said many times, you know, she didn't consider herself to be a political singer. She was just going about her life. And I think for me and many people like me, she shows us that life is political, that art is political. I know that for Trans Africa Forum, this merger, this love, this marriage between activism and art fuels much of our work. And as someone who grew up in the anti-apartheid struggles, I remember as a child listening to her and then hearing her and seeing her play a role in Serafina, not realizing who she had been. And then as I grew up, realizing what she had given to me as someone who grew up in the United States, the ability to live life on your own terms, to honor your culture through music and expression, and to be yourself.
There have been different moments where Africa and America have connected around civil rights, around international rights. I'm thinking of, you know, everything from the way that there was a dialogue with South Africa between South Africans and Americans working in the civil rights movement, to, of course, the protests that ended in America that helped provide a grounds for ending apartheid, or at least the U.S. participation economically in supporting South Africa's apartheid. Do you think that we're entering another period where we may see both culturally in terms of music and also politically more of a connection between Africa and America?
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, if you think about it, as we talked about today on your show, more people, more Africans have come to the United States in the last 20 years than the entire Middle Passage. And so Africans in the U.S. are a completely different animal than we were even a generation ago. And I think that we'll see that. And we see that through music. We see that through all of our, if you think about as a hip hop, as someone from hip hop generation, young hip hop artists, how many of them, like Jean Grey, have their roots in Southern Africa or across the continent. I think that is what I hope will be the future of both political struggle and culture this country. It's something that I'm dedicated to, and I think that you cannot have political struggle without an artistic and cultural expression of that struggle.
How do you think Miriam Makeba will live on in terms of her legacy?
I mean, her tremendous influence. I think that so for so many young people, men and women, we don't even understand how much she influenced the way in which we understand ourselves. Seeing African culture as beautiful, seeing the ways in which speaking your indigenous language is beautiful, is powerful, and can be understood by the masses, I think, is a really important point that was made. I think also just the strength of someone who could survive beautifully despite apartheid, despite being oppressed, despite being in exile. I think those things will live on. And as well, I think just the ability that you can link cultures with art. You can link people, not with just their commonalities, but with their differences through their love of art. And for me, I mean, she really is the mother of our struggle. And she will be severely missed and mourned, but also I think will give birth to another generation of sons and daughters who will follow in her footsteps.
Roxanne, thank you.
Thank you.
Roxanne Lawson is Director of Africa Policy for the Trans-Africa Forum.